Hey there, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Callin' It Podcast. I'm Alex Barth, joined by Alex Lebowitz. We are live today. In addition to the usual recording, we'll be putting this out live on the CLNS YouTube page. So if we make mentions to the here and now, that is the case. We can thank the snowstorm for that one. Lebowitz, how you doing today?
I'm doing well. I'm doing pretty well. How are you?
I'm okay. I'm done with the snow. I was grilling yesterday, and I'm still pissed at you. It was a month ago now. You said you thought we were done with snow, and I had to brush my car off this morning. We're also joined today by Matt McCarthy from 98.5 The Sports Hub. He is the host of the new 98.5 Baseball Podcast. Matt, how you doing?
I think Lebowitz must be too young to remember the April Fool's Day storm of 1997, because that storm was awesome. At least if you were a kid in the region. So, yeah, listen, snow happens at this time of year, okay, people? Get over it.
I'm not over it. I'll never get over it. I need warm weather. Home opener's, what, Thursday of this week? So, be nice. Yankees also canceling. You see the snow on Yankee Stadium? It's brutal. Anyway, who wants snow in April?
If that had happened 4 months ago, maybe Stanton would have come to Boston. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, maybe.
But, like you said, home opening. Luckily for the Red Sox, they started – luckily, I don't know how fun it is playing in the airplane hangar that is Tropicana Field. They get a bit of an upgrade now going to Miami, but they stay in the South. They'll play Monday and Tuesday night there before off day Wednesday, returning home Thursday. And after a shaky start, we'll call it, to the year in the opener, overall, I'd say a good start. The Red Sox take 3 out of 4 from the Tampa Bay Rays. And if you don't know how that first game happened and you just heard, hey, the Red Sox took 3 out of 4 to start the year, I think you have to be pretty happy with that. Especially with the starting rotation. Look, I spent the whole offseason bashing the rotation. Now, it is just Tampa Bay. Let's not get too excited, okay? Tampa Bay, not even technically a city. People don't realize that. Tampa is the city. Tampa Bay is the body of water. This baseball team represents a body of water. Who does that? But I thought, you know, and Matt, we'll start with you on this. You got to be encouraged by what you saw from the starting rotation, especially Price and Velasquez.
Sure, but then again, it's also coming against this putrid Rays lineup. Let's be totally honest. Can you name 4 guys in that Rays lineup? I'm going to put you both on the spot. You just watched the entire series. Name 4 players in the Tampa Bay Rays lineup. Go.
Well, Denard Span, I thought, was retired, but him and his gray beard are apparently there. Is Kevin Kiermaier a person?
He is a person.
Carlos Gomez.
For the Rays.
Wait, Lebowitz, you just had one?
Carlos Gomez.
Okay.
Carlos Gomez on Tampa now?
Yes.
Is that Carlos Gomez? Cargo?
Yeah, he threw up Brock Holt, the old aggressive base running Rose.
Well, I could throw up Brock Holt. I mean, you see the LBs he's put on in camp?
I want to say Robert Sucre? Is that a catcher?
I don't even know if he's on their team. So I'm not going to count that one. We're at 3, gentlemen. We're at 3.
Brad Miller.
Brad Miller. Brad Miller. Hit a home run yesterday.
Wow, congratulations. That took way longer than it could have. And it proves my point that the Tampa Bay Rays suck, okay? So, yeah, sure, it was a great start for the Red Sox starting rotation. They allow 2 runs in 24 innings. That's fantastic. Let me see that against a real major league lineup, okay? And I say that, and I believe in this starting rotation, so I'm not really trying to take anything away from them. But facts are facts. I mean, that Rays lineup isn't anything. Talk to me in 3 weeks. But as I said, I mean, I think the starting rotation is arguably the strength of this team. So I'm not, you know, I'm not trying to discredit them too much. Don't get me wrong on that.
Yeah, I think that the 2 biggest concerns for the Red Sox, it's definitely not the starting rotation. I agree with you there. Definitely the best part of this team. It's the depth of that bullpen, because outside of Matt Barnes and Craig Kimbrell, there really isn't anyone else that I would trust at this point in the season. And the lineup, I have a stat that I pulled together, 6-for-36 with runners in scoring position in that series. That's putrid. It's awful, especially against a team like the Rays. With the exception of Chris Archer, they don't really have a lot of talent in that rotation. They have a few guys. But you expect more from that line, but especially after what we saw last season. So it's great. They start off the season 3-1, but when you look at how the offense did and how the bullpen was a little bit shaky throughout, it's really not that much to get excited over.
Guys, they had 1 inning in that series where they scored multiple runs. And that inning was the Eduardo Nunez inside the park home run where he hit the ball 190 feet. And all of a sudden it starts bouncing around and, okay, well, you know, you score. So there you go. They had 1 inning in that series where they scored multiple runs. Like last year, they failed, at least in this series, and granted it's early, so let's not overreact. But at least in this series, They looked like the Red Sox offense from last year that just couldn't string hits together. You get runners on first and second. You know, Jackie Bradley Jr. can't lay down a bunt. He gets the sacrifice, tries to bunt for a base hit like the selfish ball player that he is, grounds into a double play and kills the inning. It's that type of stupid crap that worries me about the Red Sox heading into this year offensively. They've got plenty of talent, but fundamentally and situationally as a ball club offensively, I have my serious doubts about them.
Well, I will ask you this, Matt, and you talked with Sean McAdam on Hardcore Baseball, the 98.5 The Sports Hub Baseball podcast last week, and something came up about Xander Bogaerts, and I'll let you get into it more, but I just kind of want to phrase it as this. It's been like 3 or 4 years now, every year. I think you alluded to this on Twitter the other day, that this is the year Xander Bogaerts breaks out, and so much of their lineup is contingent on Xander Bogaerts breaking out. Based on what you heard from McAdam, does it give a little more credence to the fact that this could be the year for Xander Bogaerts?
To paraphrase what Sean told me on the podcast, which again you can find at 98.5thesportshub.com and the 98.5 The Sports Hub app, there's a really cheap plug for it. But what Sean told me was that perhaps there might have been a little bit of a rift between Xander Bogaerts and John Farrell, and Xander Bogaerts and Brian Butterfield, the infield coach. And what Sean said is that Bogaerts is probably the type of player who does better with a pat on the back instead of a kick in the pants. And John Farrell is a notorious hard ass. And Brian Butterfield, as Sean McAdam described him, can be a bit of a drill sergeant. So I think there are some questions as to whether, you know, there was friction between Xander Bogaerts and the previous coaching staff. And I think maybe where that might have manifested itself is we've seen three times now in Xander Bogaerts' career, 2014, the second half of 2016, and the second half of 2017, where things have spiraled out of control for him, and he hasn't been able to get back on the right track. And I feel like where that may have manifested itself, and this is me taking what Sean said on the podcast, is that perhaps Farrell and Butterfield and the previous coaching staff weren't able to help Bogaerts get out of those slumps. And out of those, you know, when things aren't going right, things went way downhill for Bogaerts. Now, I think Bogaerts absolutely deserves a lot of blame for that. I mean, you know, first and foremost, you have to blame the player. But I wonder if the coaching staff was able to put a young player in a best position to succeed and help a young player through struggles. And I feel like maybe Alex Cora can reach Xander Bogaerts. At least that's the hope. You know, Cora was widely regarded for doing a very good job with Carlos Correa. Now, Carlos Correa is a better player than Xander Bogaerts, and Carlos Correa has never gone through the slumps that Xander Bogaerts has gone through. But Cora got a lot of credit on that Astros team last year, working well with the young players, notably Correa, Bregman, I mean, Springer, run down the list. So if he's able to come in here and get through to a guy like Bogaerts, and just, you know, when things start going wrong, be able to pull him aside and help him get out of it, I think that could be one of the biggest impacts that Alex Cora could have this year.
And I mean, you've been covering Bogaerts since you were with the Portland Sea Dogs when he was. It seems to me, following his career coming up, that he didn't really get in these slumps in the minors. Maybe I'm just missing that because we tend to over-exaggerate the ability of prospects, but it seems to be a major league problem for him.
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. Bogaerts really didn't have any struggles in the minors. He had a slow start in 2013 in Portland in AA, and then that was it. I mean, he had a slow month. And I think you can oftentimes attribute the weather to that. I mean, Xander himself will say it a million times. Listen, he's from Aruba. You know, when it drops below 60 degrees, this is not a comfort zone for him, which is a problem when you play in Boston, by the way. But Xander Bogaerts is a player who never failed. And you see this a lot with players who come up through the minors. Sometimes these guys don't fail at the minor league level. Jackie Bradley Jr. was a player who never failed as well. He didn't fail until he got to the big league level. And oftentimes with young players, they don't know how to handle it. I had a scout for the Houston Astros tell me in Portland 5 years ago when he was watching Travis Shaw. And Travis Shaw was hitting 220. We were talking a little bit about Shaw and his ability. And I kind of expressed my doubts in Shaw's ability. He said, I like seeing this. I want to see how a young player reacts to failing, because oftentimes they don't get to fail until they get to this level or even beyond. And he said, the good ones figure a way out of it. And I feel like Xander Bogaerts is one of those players who hasn't figured out how to fail yet. And maybe Alex Cora can help him with that process, because he's not going to, you know, do what he did in the first three games of this season. That's not going to happen. You know, he's not going to go out there and go 3 for 4 with two doubles every night. I mean, it's just not going to happen. What happens, you know, when he gets a little bit beat up a bit? What happens when he gets run down? Because he's going to have to play a lot of games again this year at shortstop, because you're not trotting Brock Holt out there every night. That's for sure. What happens when he gets run down? What happens when he starts to fail? Is Alex Cora able to help him through that? I want to see that, because I feel like John Farrell wasn't able to do that.
And it's funny that you say that, because he was hyped from the start. He was a guy who was considered to be the next superstar shortstop. It was him, and you could look at Carlos Correa, who I think is a year or two younger. But Bogarts was the future of not only the Red Sox, but one of the most marketable guys, or potentially the most marketable guy in the MLB after that 2013 run. And he just fell off, and I think he hit the nail on the head. He was never really challenged. He was hyped from the start. And once he faced adversity, whether it be a manager who he didn't get along with or a wrist injury, he couldn't overcome that. And that's a problem. And bigger picture, when you're looking at three guys in Betts, Bradley, and Bogarts, and maybe you can add Benintendi into that group, who's the guy, who's the odd man out? For me, at this point today, it's Xander Bogarts. So this is, I think, for the entire roster, this is the most important season for him specifically.
Oh, I agree. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. I think we were about to say the same thing, but go ahead.
So the thing about Bogarts is, if you had asked the Red Sox 5 years ago who's going to be anchoring your lineup in 2018, everybody in that front office, everybody involved with that organization would have said Xander Bogarts is going to be our three hitter. He's going to hit 27 home runs and drive in 100 every year, and he's going to hit, you know, 290. You know, everybody in that organization would have said this. Xander Bogarts, as great a hitter as Mookie Betts is, and I will, you know, go to my grave defending Xander Bogarts, because I believe in his ability more so than any player on this team. I kid you not. Mookie Betts is a great hitter, but Mookie Betts can't go to the opposite field consistently. This is a point that Tony Mazz has made. The Red Sox have some really great hitters on paper, but you can pitch to just about every one of them. Mookie Betts, who attack away, because he's not going to go the other way. When Xander Bogarts is locked in, and we've seen it at times, the problem is we have not seen it consistently enough, he can go the other way. He can, you know, pull it for power. You can't pitch to him when he's locked in. The Red Sox don't have many of those guys. All right, even when Mookie Betts is locked in, you can pitch to him. Xander Bogarts has that rare ability. He has not consistently shown that, and I think this is a put-up or shut-up year for Bogarts. He's 25 now. All right, and he's still a kid. He's 25, but you know what? This is going to be in August. It's going to be 5 years in the big leagues for him. All right, now it's time for Xander Bogarts to take that step forward this year. If he takes that step forward offensively, they will be fine, because he has the ability to anchor that lineup. Not saying he's going to, and because at this point we can't act like it's automatically going to happen anymore. If you had asked us, you know, going into 2014, we all would have acted like this was automatically going to happen. We can't say that yet with Bogarts, but if he does, and again, if I threw 98 miles an hour, I'd be a big league pitcher, but I don't. It's an if. If he does that, the Red Sox will be fine. He's the key player on the Red Sox this year.
And that actually leads me real quick here, because we're running up against it on this segment, but if you could throw 98, you'd be a big league pitcher, leads perfectly in the last thing I wanted to talk about. Joe Kelly can throw 98.
Yeah.
Real quick, because we touched on it a little bit here and there in Lovitz. I know you said game one was not on Cora. It was on the bullpen. It wasn't right to put Kimbrel in there. You were fine with him not putting Kimbrel in. Yeah. We disagree there, and we could get into all of that. But how 1 to 10, because we got to keep it quick, how comfortable are you with this bullpen going forward, at least for a couple of months before Tyler Thornburg gets healthy and maybe they can trade or sign somebody?
I'm about a 5. I'll put it right down the middle. I just don't know. And Joe Kelly, I think, someone who can pick it up and turn it around. I believe he's a talented pitcher, and I think his place is in the bullpen. And we've seen him have success in the bullpen. So I'm not super concerned with that. I'm concerned with Carson Smith, probably a little bit more than Joe Kelly, just because his sample size with the Red Sox isn't quite as extensive. But it really comes down to the depth, because, again, beyond Kimbrel and Barnes, and eventually I think we will add Kelly into that mix. I think he will pick it up. They don't have a lot of depth there. And I don't know whether Thornburg's going to be enough. Him coming back will be enough for them to overcome that. But it's clearly the major weakness on this Red Sox team. And I think eventually we could see them making a deal to bring someone else in who can bolster up that bullpen.
I'm going to say a four, and let's do a very quick exercise here. 30 seconds. I'm going to give you a name, and you need to either give me a yes or no answer as to whether you trust him. Craig Kimbrel.
Yes, yes, of course.
Carson Smith.
No.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Joe Kelly. Okay,
not to close the game, but I trust Carson Smith, like the role he was used in yesterday.
Okay. Joe Kelly.
No. Right now, no. Not right now.
Matt Barnes.
Yes.
Heath Embry.
No.
Yeah, I think he's a good,
this is tough. Do I trust him in the sixth inning against 7, 8, 9? Yeah. Do I trust him in the ninth against 3, 4, 5? No.
No, no. Yeah. I'll go in between.
Yeah, I'm right in the middle there.
Yeah. A lot of no's in there. We'll keep it at that. We're not even going to hit on Pointer and Walden because they won't be here.
Yeah. I like Pointer's potential, but that's another conversation for another day. Speaking of another conversation, we put out a poll over the weekend. Got some very interesting results, especially those of you who are loyal CLNS media followers. We'll touch on that on the other side. This is Calling It, powered by CLNS.
Calling It is brought to you by American Broadcast Coaches, training the next generation of media talent and communicators. For more information, check out AmericanBroadcastCoaches.com.
Welcome back to Calling It. Alex Barth, Alex Lebowitz, Matt McCarthy from 98.5 joins us today as well. We are simulcasting this live on YouTube. This is like a poor, poor, poor man's Felgren Maz right now, I feel like.
Homeless.
Homeless man's Felgren Maz. There you go. Anyway.
You're so right, Alex. You're so right.
I love you, man. That's a good one.
You quoted Maz already, Matt, I think earlier, right?
Yeah, I already dropped one Maz. So
there we go.
We've got our Maz dose.
To be fair, actually, none of the EEI shows are simulcast, right? I was just saying, to be fair to the whole market, but
there was one, but that
there was one back in the day, but I don't know, something happened there.
Happened. We won't get into that. What we will get into is this poll we put out over the weekend. This was in response to, I think this was before the two big games on Saturday night. When did I put this up? The 29th would have been Friday. Whenever. Anyway. So this is not which Boston coach will win coach of the year, because I think we know Brad Stevens will win coach of the year. Bruce Cassidy is neck and neck with the coach out in Vegas whose name is escaping me right now.
Gerard Gallant.
Gerard, thank you. If Boston awarded a coach of the year, who would it be? The options were Bruce Cassidy, Brad Stevens, Bill Belichick, and other. And I just, before we get into the real conversation, 1%, but I think it's less than 1%. I think it's one person because we had over 100 votes. One person said other, and I'm going to assume, I'm going to hope that that's somebody trying to give Brad Friedel some love or Sean Quirk some love, because you can't in all consciousness give that vote to John Farrell. And yet, unless you're a huge fan of getting bounced in the first round, I don't think you can give that vote to Farrell.
They won two straight AL East titles. Come on.
Oh, man. Yeah, you're right. That really competes with making a Super Bowl and being the best team in the conference.
That vote came from Jess Moran.
Okay. on that note, so the results were, so initially when the poll went out, it was heavily skewed towards Bruce Cassidy. When it was retweeted by CLNS, and we know that they have a heavy Celtics following, it jumped up to Brad Stevens getting 71% of the vote. Bruce Cassidy got 18, Bill Belichick got a healthy 10, and then the 1% going to the coach of the Revolution and the Cannons. So guys, my question to you, Matt, I'll start with you. Who is Boston's coach of the year?
It's Bruce Cassidy. It's easily Bruce Cassidy. And I know, you know, the Green Teamers are going to get a little upset by that. And Stevens has done a fantastic job, and I'm not trying to take anything away from him. I would say, though, that we've seen this from the Celtics before. We've seen a lot of regular season success. The last three seasons they've overachieved in the regular season. So I feel like I'm almost punishing Brad Stevens for his consistent excellence. But what the Bruins have done under Bruce Cassidy has been spectacular. The Bruins have overachieved more this year than the Celtics have. And I know the Celtics have been hurt, but let's be honest, they've had Kyrie Irving for most of the year. The NBA is a star league. I know they haven't had him for the last 2 weeks, and they're 6-0, and that's great. And I'm not taking anything away from Brad Stevens. But Bruce Cassidy benched his starting goalie in November when this team was not doing well. He benched Tuukka Rask, his $6-7 million a year goalie, and it turned the season around. Every button Bruce Cassidy has pressed has been the right one. The feel for his team has, I mean, it's been marvelous this year. Every move that he makes is the right one. Torrey Krug, you know, had that game earlier. I forget who it was. Was it against Washington? I'm not sure. He had the game where he was struggling in the 3-on-3, and he took him off the ice in the 3-on-3. Didn't, you know, put him on 9 like Claude would have done for 5 games. Took him off the ice. He was back out there the next night. Bruce Cassidy has been excellent with these young players. Somebody struggles, okay, you go up on 9 for a game, maybe 2, but then you come right back down. What'd you see up there? What'd you learn? Focus on your game. All right, you're getting another chance. The accountability that Bruce Cassidy has instilled in his team, I think, is outstanding. He has been, it's just amazing what this Bruins team has accomplished under him.
Love it. How about you?
You're going Bruce Cassidy. I think it's a toss-up. I'm going to go Brad Stevens, though. They had a completely overturned roster, barely any returners, really. And I know they had Kyrie Irving, and I know they made some additions. But Brad Stevens, if you look at the body of work, and I know that's not what this award's about, it's undeniable that he is turning into the best coach in New England. And he's about to surpass Bill Belichick.
Okay, no. Hold on. First of all, it's just this year. Okay, if it's who's the best coach currently in Boston, it's Belichick, easy. Belichick, and I Nick Gelso made this argument last week.
Yeah.
Bill Belichick has 5 rings, okay?
I'm saying he's becoming a better coach. He's going to be a better, like, he's going to have a better reputation. Not a better reputation, but in my opinion, he'll be more valuable to the Celtics within the next 2 years than Belichick will be. And I know Belichick's looking at retirement, but if you look at all the reports, are you saying
currently or ever? Because Bill Belichick is arguably the greatest coach in professional team sports. Are you saying
that's ridiculous?
Going to pass that, not having been past the second round.
This is really more about Belichick leaving his prime. He's a guy who's obviously losing some control of that locker room. Players are getting sick of playing for him. He's having rifts with the owner and rifts with the quarterback. So if we're going off of this year, Belichick isn't even in the conversation for coach of the year, even though they did make the Super Bowl.
Well, that's the thing. Belichick's made a championship. I don't think Stevens is making a championship. Cassidy, we'll see. If Cassidy makes a Stanley Cup, he probably passes Bill. But Bill made a championship.
Okay, and he has Tom Brady as a quarterback.
Sorry, I hate to interrupt. Bill probably cost his team a Super Bowl by benching Butler.
He got there.
Of course he got there. They always get there. And you know, that's not taking anything away from, you know, what the Patriots have accomplished. But this was, and granted, they made the Super Bowl. This was one of the rockiest years of the Bill Belichick tenure. No doubt about it.
But I think we in New England undervalue what it means to make the Super Bowl. Just because they get there every year doesn't mean it's easy.
No, of course we do. But this has not been a great stretch for Bill. All right, it was not a great offseason for Bill last year. Look, I mean, Dwayne Allen, Coney Ealy, and they still made the Super Bowl. Maybe because they have the greatest quarterback of all time.
Yeah, that might have.
But, I mean, and, you know, Bill obviously did a, you know, pretty good job getting them to the Super Bowl until he had, you know, one of the biggest brain farts of his entire career. All right? Bill screwed the pooch in the Super Bowl. That's the way it goes.
But they played the Titans and the Jags on their way there.
But he got himself to that stage. Until Brad Stevens even puts himself in the position to bench Kyrie Irving in the NBA Finals, to bench Al Horford in the NBA Finals, Belichick still got to that point. Stevens hasn't come close.
Who did the Patriots need to beat to get to the Super Bowl? Like honestly.
They beat the Steelers. It's getting the Super Bowl is not just about winning 2 games.
Because Ben Roethlisberger blew it. And that was in the regular season, in the playoffs. And it wouldn't matter because the Steelers – although it would have rearranged things. The Steelers blew it against Jacksonville. They blew it against the Patriots. And that's a poorly coached team in general. So you got to beat the Titans and the Jaguars to get to the Super Bowl. It's an accomplishment, but is it really that big of an accomplishment? You had the greatest quarterback of all time. To say that that's a result of Bill Belichick's coaching is, I think, over the top. I'm not taking anything away from the guy's legacy. I mean, just look at the Wickersham piece. Look at what you're seeing with Rob Gronkowski, and there's continuous frustrations between those two growing. Brad Stevens is a guy who has complete control of that locker room, albeit it's a 12-15 man roster compared to a 53 man roster. But still, He's overperformed time and time again. You can't look at Bill Belichick and say that he's necessarily overperformed. He's benefited from having the best quarterback in the league, and obviously his football IQ has something to do with it. But I'm sticking with Brad Stevens. I think within the next 2 years, he'll have a better reputation in Boston currently.
Just 2017, 2018, just that season. Are you telling me reaching the Super Bowl, the hardest championship to win in sports, and I know the hockey hardos are going to come at me and say it's a Stanley Cup, it's a Super Bowl, because you have one bad game, you're out. Are you telling me reaching the Super Bowl is less impressive than dominating an Eastern Conference when you get to play the New York Knicks five times a year and the Brooklyn Nets five times a year and the Philadelphia 76ers five times a year, even if they are a new look team?
Play this year.
Okay, the Patriots have to play the Jets twice a year.
But I'm just saying, you want to talk about beating up on bad teams. All Brad Stevens has done this year is beat up on bad teams. The games
really
that have been,
so the Warriors, the Rockets.
The Rockets game was won by Marcus Smart, and I know that's going to open up a completely different can of worms.
Rozier was better.
Game was bad. There you go. We'll have to have you on again over the offseason to discuss that, Matt. But the Rockets game was won by Marcus Smart. Okay, being in the right position. Brad Stevens drew up a couple bad plays at the end of that game. The one in Indianapolis where they had the last second steal, they turned it over a couple possessions before because Brad Stevens didn't draw up a good inbounds play. The teams they have, the blowouts, well, they are fun, have come against the bad teams. Brad Stevens has taken care of business against the bad teams. That's not anything bad. There's been coaches here that couldn't do it. We all know Claude Julien, when the Bruins played a basement team, you were scared because they always slept for those games. They couldn't get up to play the Florida Panthers 3 years ago, to play the New Jersey Devils, right?
Yeah.
But Belichick got his team to the doorstep. And until the other two do that, and I don't think the Celtics are making the championship this year. Bruce Cassidy maybe will change my mind. I think they can get to the Cup Finals.
I think
until somebody does,
you're saying Belichick. You're saying Belichick's the coach of the year after benching Malcolm Butler and essentially, in my opinion and Matt's opinion, losing the Patriots a Super Bowl.
Yeah, because they got him to that point.
Okay, but it was still a disaster of a season for Patriots standards. And if you're going off of the standard that he has, you know, built up in New England, I mean, you have to take that into consideration. This year was a disappointment for the Patriots. So I think that's relevant when we're talking about this. It's between Bruce Cassidy and Brad Stevens. I think Bill Belichick's not even in the conversation.
Let me ask you guys this real quick then, because you both seem to be on opposite sides of this, so I want to phrase the conversation a different way, because this is something I think's gone understated. You have two extremes where Brad Stevens took a completely retooled roster. The Celtics had, what, four players back from last season?
Yeah.
Right? Four players back, and they are among the top teams in the Eastern Conference, among the top teams in the NBA. On the other side, Bruce Cassidy took a team that was almost identical to a team that last year barely made the playoffs and has turned them into the favorite for the Stanley Cup. He brought up new kids, but the point is, these are kids that could have been given a chance last year that weren't by Julien. He saw the ability to give them a chance. So what's more impressive, taking a team that last year had the same players but underachieved in bringing them up to a championship level, or taking a completely retooled roster and instantly putting them in championship contention, which is more impressive?
The latter, because what Bruce Cassidy did is just correct all of Claude Julien's mistakes. I think you can also look at the fact that all those players, the McAvoys, the DeBrusque, all the young guys, they got a year older. They got a year better, and you still have guys like Krejci, Bergeron, and Marchand who are still, you know, in their prime or maybe they're towards the end, but they're still very good players. I think the timing was great for Bruce Cassidy to come in and step in as a new coach. With Brad Stevens, he had a revamped roster, and he needed to make sure the chemistry was on point from the start, and it has been. And they're better this year than they were last year, and they've been better every single year after, you know, he started. So he's gotten better. He's gotten completely better. I know this is only related to this season. But what Brad Stevens did with a revamped roster is very impressive. What Bruce Cassidy did with that roster is simply just utilize it correctly and correct the mistakes that Claude Julien made.
Matt,
I just wanted to highlight that Brad Friedel is really handling the Lee Wynn situation well, because I think you got to get rid of him. You know, he's I don't know if he wants to be here. I mean, way to be as a new head coach. You really put your foot down. Oh, you want to hold out? Okay, you're not going to play. Brad Friedel, coach of the year in New England. I like it.
Okay.
Hey, Sean Quirk's team barely beat Brown University in a scrimmage a couple of weeks ago.
So let's move on.
Head coach of the Boston Cannons.
Oh, yeah. Get excited.
The one other question I wanted to bring up, and kind of as I was writing it, I realized it was ridiculous. Which coach has dealt with injury better, Stevens or Cassidy? And that's got to be a draw, right? You think about as impressive as the Bruins and Celtics have been, and there's a lot of similarities between the two, there's a lot of differences as well. The injuries, though, really seem to it's almost like this Bruins season, the Celtics season were meant to happen at the same time. And I know that's a little, dramatic.
There are a lot of parallels.
There are a lot of parallels, which has made it that much more fun.
I think Stevens has handled it better just because the percentage of his roster, a higher percentage of his roster has dealt with injury. And you look at a guy like Kyrie, and you can even go back to Hayward. A lot of people think that's unfair at this point in the season. But those guys have a much greater impact on the Celtics than any player on the Bruins does. Just because of the different sports. So I'm going to give the edge to Stevens on that one.
I think it's also easier to withstand major injuries in hockey, too, because, there's more depth in that sport. And the whole sport, it's not a star league. I mean, sure, you know, where would the Bruins be without that top line this year? But, look at Don Sweeney going out and adding all these solid depth pieces at the deadline, Wingles, Gionta, holding them and run down the list. It's been nice for Bruce Cassidy to be able to roll those guys out there. I think it's easier to manage injuries in hockey because it's more a part of the game, to be totally honest.
And that's another question that we should bring up another time. I don't think we have time now. But
yeah, we got five seconds left, real quick.
Who's had a better season or past couple of years as an executive, Ainge or Sweeney? Because that's really close too. Both have done an exceptional job.
Dave Dombrowski. Okay, that's enough time for this segment.
Dombrowski.
that is all time we have, unfortunately, for this segment, because I want to make sure we save time for the other side, a tradition unlike any other, the Masters. We'll discuss it after this. This is Calling It, powered by CLNS.
Calling It is brought to you by American Broadcast Coaches, training the next generation of media talent and communicators. For more information, check out AmericanBroadcastCoaches.com.
Welcome back to Calling It. Alex Barth, Alex Lovewitz. We are powered by CLNS Media. You can follow them on Twitter at CLNS Media. Follow our show as well at Calling It Podcast. Matt McCarthy joining us today as well from 98.5 The Sports.
Yeah, I'm still around.
Still here.
Still hanging out.
You want to talk some golf?
Always. Always. You know, I'm not kidding. I'm a pretty big golf fan. So, yes, please.
I think we all have been in the last couple of years because everybody was worried about the post-Tiger era. And what happened is, and there was a year or two where it was a little slow, but now all these guys who grew up watching Tiger, who were inspired by Tiger, who were in a way created by Tiger, right? He got them to put down the baseball glove, put down the lacrosse stick, put away the soccer ball, pick up a golf club. Now they're all coming for his title. And all of a sudden, Tiger Woods is back to compete with them. This, to me, is setting up to be the most hyped, the most fun, the most intense, the most epic Masters tournament in the last deck, really since the last one Tiger was in. And even if you want to include the last couple Tiger was in, I mean, you have to go way back to find the last Masters, I think, that had as much hype as this one will.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that. I mean, just the Tiger factor. I don't even think Tiger needs to be at a point where he's consistently winning tournaments anymore to help golf. Tiger just needs to be in the running. Because if he's in the running on Sunday, he doesn't need to win. But if he's, a couple shots off the lead, kind of first, second page of the leaderboard, everybody will be watching on Sunday. Everybody will be. And as you mentioned, there's kind of been a coming of age for these younger golfers. You can criticize them for just being robotic and boring, like, Spieth and Justin Thomas and Rory McIlroy. But there are a lot of really good young golfers. Maybe they sure as hell don't have the personality that, Tiger has. But wouldn't you love to see Tiger and Justin Thomas in the same pairing on Sunday? I mean, I don't know if this is going to happen. I know Tiger's short game looks like it's ready for Augusta. I'm not sure if his approach game is, ready to win the Masters at this point. But I think Tiger can compete on Sunday, and I think he can be in the mix, and that would be amazing for golf.
I think if he's going to make any of the majors interesting, it's got to be the Masters, right?
And
you said, I think it was 2 weeks ago, you don't think he's going to win another major. Correct me if I'm wrong. I think we have you on tape saying that, though.
I said that before. What was the latest?
You said it after. I think it was the week after the Valspar when we were talking about.
Okay, it was it was the first time he came in and he really he made some headlines. And since then he had another tournament in which he finished top five.
Obama.
So he's been more consistent. And I think what I was initially – the point I was trying to make is we should wait to see how he does in a major before we completely buy into the Tiger hype, to the fact that he is back. And I think if we do see him in the mix, he's someone who will compete and who will draw more attention. And we've seen it. The viewership for tournaments that he's in has been through the roof the last couple that he has been in. So – it's obvious the guy's great for golf. It's obvious he's electric and he's entertaining, not to mention the storyline behind it and how there was that big absence. He's been dealing with injuries. So I'm excited to see how he does. I'm going to be watching, especially that third and fourth round. And a lot of it really is going to come down to how he starts on Thursday and Friday. If he gets off to a good start, boy, the hype's going to be real. And it's going to be a lot of fun to watch it go down the stretch.
Yeah, the most disappointing thing that could happen this weekend is for him to make the cut, but to miss the cut. Pardon me.
Yeah.
I don't think that's going to be an issue. The thing with Tiger for me, and I've said this before, it seems like ever since the back surgery, he'll have a competitive first round, second round, sometimes third round, even into the fourth round. But once he hits those final 9 to 18 holes, you just see him kind of fade, and it is a conditioning thing. He does need to build the strength back up. But we saw it right at the Valspar where he was pretty much even. I think he did finish even or one under on the final day. At the Austin Palmer, he did not have the same – it didn't look like Tiger on day four like it did days one through three. Now, you would like to think that if he's on a conditioning plan, it's all building up to the Masters, and his plan was to be good to go for a full four rounds for this weekend. And I think you saw him really over-hitting the ball at the Arnold Palmer like we've never really seen him do. And I think part of that was he's been fine-tuning his game these last couple tournaments. He's not out there to win. He's out there to figure out, okay, now that my back's repaired, now that I'm in this shape, how far can I hit the ball? How well can I chip it? What am I doing with my 7-iron? What am I doing with my 9-iron? Figure it all out. And you hope that all that experimentation was leading up to this weekend. And if it was, that to me is what would give him a chance to win it, is if the miscues we've seen from him for the last couple of weeks, and call us a conspiracy theory if you want, the miscues we've seen from him the last couple of weeks were, I don't want to say on purpose, but just experiments to figure out what he needs to do right in the Masters.
Just a quick point to what you said there. I think Freddie Couples is in many ways the perfect example of a guy who, Freddie Couples has had a bad back forever. And you'll always see, and I guarantee you, I mean, take this to the bank, the sun will rise, the sun will set, and Fred Couples is going to shoot under par at the Masters this weekend, because he always does. And, you'll be sitting there at the end of Saturday saying, man, Freddie Couples is only like 3 off the lead, and he's going to fade on Sunday because, the back just can't hold up. So you have to wonder if Tiger Woods is going to have that type of situation pop up for him, for the rest of his career. Whether the back will never truly be the same by the time once you get to Sunday, you're just not going to be able to hang around. We'll see. Yeah, but I think it's an excellent point. He did kind of fade on those Sundays. He had those moments, where he had that big eagle, I think, at the Arnold Palmer, and you're like, man, Tiger's going to do this, and you just faded on the final few holes. We'll see if that's an issue for him.
Well, and when's the last time he's golfed this much in like a 3-month span? That's another thing.
2013.
And again, it goes back to the conditioning.
Yeah.
But sorry, go ahead.
So it's going to, maybe there is, it's inevitable that he's going to get re-injured. Who knows? The guy's not young. He's in his 40s. And again, he has that injury history. I feel like at some point something might give, and I want to see him, continue to thrive because it's great for golf. But I don't know. If he does well, I'll buy in a little bit. But in the back of my mind, there'll always be that injury history and the fact that his back is made of glass. So we'll see how it goes.
Well, let me ask you guys this then: if not Tiger, who do you like this weekend?
Justin Thomas, hottest golfer in the world right now. I'll take Justin Thomas.
Number two. Well, he's number two in the world. He's so according to your logic, you should pick Dustin Johnson.
Yeah, Dustin Johnson is not the hottest golfer in the world right now. I mean, Justin Thomas, going back to last year, is the best golfer on tour right now. He already has, what, one or two wins at this point already in the season. You know, Dustin Johnson a couple weeks ago was out early at the Match Play Championship. You know, world rankings, you know, they take into, I don't know how far they go back, how, you know, but it takes a long time to lose that number one spot. Justin Thomas is the best golfer in the world right now. I will take him.
Lebo, how about you?
Not Tiger. I don't know. maybe McIlroy. I haven't given it much thought.
So this is like our MLB Rookie of the Year pick. You're just not Ohtani?
You know, and I regret picking Ohtani because I just did that out of pressure. It's the only rookie.
No, not Ohtani.
What?
We picked not Ohtani.
Oh, I said not Ohtani. Okay, yeah. I did. Okay.
We don't know any MLB. Matt probably knows MLB Rookie. I don't know who's a rookie. I was very disappointed Devers isn't a rookie. But
yeah,
that's another conversation.
So I don't know who's going to win. I don't know. I'm up in the air. My guess is probably not going to be the correct pick. So I'm going to leave it open.
Based on what you said, are you rooting for or against Tiger?
I'm rooting for Tiger. I wanted to see him play well because, again, he is the key to that sport's success. We saw when he fell off the game of golf, not the PGA, literally the game itself, the sport fell off. They started converting golf courses into frisbee golf and soccer golf, like a bunch of weird stuff that is just so over the top and ridiculous and circusy. So yeah, I want to see him do well, just because a sport is dying because he's not relevant. So yeah, I'm definitely rooting for Tiger.
So kind of a similar question here before we wrap the show up. Let's just pretend, let's have some fun with this. Let's say Tiger is in it on Sunday, right? Like really in it. Okay, towards top of the leaderboard. Who of anybody in the field, what would be the best pairing on Sunday for Tiger? The most epic, the most dramatic lead up, whether he wins or not, for Tiger to have a chance, what would be the most fun pairing to watch?
Tiger and Phil.
Yeah.
I mean, really, you know, even though Justin Thomas, as I said, is the best golfer in the world right now, I mean, that was my first, you know, reaction to say it, but the best thing for golf would be Tiger and Phil in the final pairing.
I would love to see Spieth, just because Tiger and Spieth, because you kind of mentioned it. The reason a lot of these guys picked up golf clubs in the first place was because of Tiger Woods. So to see the old school guy, the one of the most dominant golfers ever, to be with an up and comer who's American, and probably started playing the sport because of Tiger in a way, I think that would be awesome to see those two matched up.
So I'm going to look, both those would be incredible. But I'm going to go Tiger and Sergio Garcia.
Ooh. What is this? Ooh. Sergio.
First of all, people forget, Sergio won the Masters last year. Which Sergio winning the Masters in itself was insane last year.
Yeah.
Not just the way he won it, but Sergio's not supposed to win a Masters.
Sergio can you know, miss the cut this weekend. Nobody would give a damn.
No, they wouldn't. You're right.
They sing, to be totally honest.
But this reaction is why I want to see it, okay? If it's Spieth, or if it's Rory, or if it's Ricky, or if it's Phil, it's a feel-good story. They're friends, right? That guy's going to be rooting for Tiger. Tiger and Sergio hate each other, like legitimately dislike each other, and everybody hates Sergio. How great is the script that here's this guy who has no business winning the Masters, wins it last year, and then back comes Tiger Woods to say, not so fast. The best Tiger is angry Tiger. The angriest Tiger is paired with Sergio. Let Tiger erase from all of our memories Sergio's Masters victory by whooping him up and down 18 holes on Sunday at Augusta.
And then that, have Sergio put the jacket on him at the end.
And then what?
And then Sergio would put the jacket on him at the end.
That is right. That is right. You can't tell me as much as it would suck with Sergio possibly winning, if Tiger ends up winning that, you can't tell me that wouldn't be incredible theater.
You've got me convinced. All right. You've got me convinced. Sold.
All right. That'll do it for us this week. We'll be recapping the Masters next week. Talk more Red Sox as well. Celtics, Bruins near the playoffs. Might squeeze a little Patriots in. I'm sure Bill's got something up his sleeve. It's been like a week. He's been way too quiet. They haven't done anything. I'm getting suspicious. But anyway, we'll talk about that all next week. Matt, thanks for coming on.
Always good to be on with you guys.
Plug the show one more time if you want.
Hardcore Baseball, 98.5 The Sports Hub. You can find it at 98.5thesportshub.com or the 98.5 The Sports Hub app. Hashtag tap that app.
Quick, clean, easy. There you go. Lebowitz, another great episode, sir. I don't know. I was going to ask you to – you plug your stuff.
Yeah, Monday through Friday, 6 to 10 a.m., 980 WCAP. It's not really sports related. It's a lot of political talk, but it's a good time. Merrimack Valley Radio in the morning.
So, you guys, what'd you do opening day the other day? You told me. I can't remember what you guys did for opening day. It was something ridiculous.
The opening day, what did we do? My memory.
Is that you?
Stinks. My co-host said that he wishes Fenway Park was torn down 30 years ago.
That's what it was.
Yeah, so that was one of the – yeah, I wanted to murder him for a period of time. So blast, absolutely. I got very, very angry in studio. It was a lot of fun.
So for Matt McCarthy, Alex Lovitz, I'm Alex Parthian. You know you can find me. Same time, same place, as always. This has been the Callin' It Podcast. Follow us on Twitter, at Callin' It Podcast. You can check us out on clnsmedia.com. We will talk to you next week. Goodbye.